Welcome to the premiere of Rolling Stone Magazine's One-on-One, a series of intimate conversations with some of rock's most eloquent voices. To inaugurate the series, we're honored to have as our first guest, Mr. Pete Townsend. Rolling Stone One-on-One is brought to you by AT&T and by Dentene. We'll take care of your breath. The rest is up to you. And now, Pete Townsend One-on-One with our host, Vin Skelson.
Well, to paraphrase a line from a song at the very beginning of The Who's Tommy, I've got a feeling 93 is going to be a good year, or at least a very busy year for Pete Townsend. April brings a full-scale, glorious production of Tommy to Broadway, complete with a book co-written by Pete Townsend. Early summer promises the release of a new solo album from Pete Townsend, and of course 1993 marks the 30th anniversary of The Who, with word from Townsend that he and Roger Daltrey are possibly cooking up something really big in observance of that, and we'll ask him in just a minute, because as we inaugurate Rolling Stone's One-on-One syndicated radio show, it is very appropriate that we have as our very first guest Mr. Pete Townsend. Pete, welcome.
Thank you.
When you first mentioned the idea of a rock opera, some kind of vague, nebulous thing, back in Rolling Stone in 1968, something you were calling Deaf, Dumb, and Blind Boy, did you ever imagine that 25 years later, Tommy would not only be alive and kicking, but would be the toast of the Great White Way?
No, I didn't. I certainly didn't imagine that that Rolling Stone would be hosting radio shows. You know, in a sense, it says it all, doesn't it? It was me and Jan Wenner, who's now, you know, a big media king, and with offices all around the world, and me, you know, rolling joints in the Jefferson Aeroplane's front room and talking about this little idea that I had. And I think no, of course I didn't know. I didn't know that where it was going to go or whether it was even going to happen. It was partly the response, Jan's response to the conversation that we'd had, the fact that he printed the article that I'd done over like something like 15 pages of his magazine, that made me confident that it was worth really pushing particularly hard. It was one of the incidents. I mean, I think the main thing that made me confident was Kit Lambert, who was the manager of The Who at the time, his conviction that I could through compose, as he used to call it, a piece. If I can give you the sequence, what actually happened first is that in the singles band period of The Who, I was already, almost on my third song, starting to think about conceptual pieces. This actually happened because of a joke. I had an apartment in London, and I let this friend of Keith's stay there. It was like a big studio in Soho. And it was mainly recording studios. The guy called Ray Tolliday. And he got me, he said, I've got this libretto for an opera, and I'd like you to write the music of it. So we spent an evening doing this joke opera for Kit Lambert, and it was called Gratis Amatis. It was all written in Cod Latin. It was a bit like kind of Gilbert and Sullivan. And it was about five or six songs, and it ran for about 10 minutes or something. And I played it to Kit, and Kit laughed. I thought it was very funny. But when Ray had gone, he said to me, you know, this is really very interesting that you can do this. He said, I know it's a joke. He said, but, you know, you can do this Gilbert and Sullivan stuff. You can do it as though you were born to do it. And he said, you should continue to try to do that kind of thing.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
When Kit said you were born to it, is that is part of that the whole upbringing in terms of England and the music hall?
I think
surrounding
that's right.
And all of that.
Yeah, what you have to remember is that You know, I don't feel at all uncomfortable in a Broadway theatre. But I actually was brought up in theatres. You know, my father was a musician in a dance band, so I was brought up in two places. During the week, we were in dance halls, so you know, I know what to do when people start fighting. And this is as young as 2 or 3 years old. You know, I was running around dance halls. My mother used to sing with my dad's band. I was kind of on the loose, wow. You know, with guys that drank. And, you know, I was a real kind of rock and roll baby.
So this is late 40s, early 50s?
Early 50s. Yeah. Late 40s, early 50s. But equally, a lot of my summers were with my dad because they would do summer seasons of holiday camps and places like that.
And holiday camps, not unlike the holiday camps
absolutely, very much
wind
so,
up in Tommy.
That's right. Yeah. The other thing that they used to do at weekends was these Sunday concerts, where they would be like variety shows. So there would be dancing girls, comedians, big stars from the USA. And that backstage was really, that was grease paint time. And I remember bringing the curtain down on one occasion. I won't tell you who the artist was because it was a silly thing to do, but me and my friend, when we were about 7 years old, brought the curtain down on an artist that we didn't like. You know, we don't like him, get him off.
You didn't have a hook, huh? So you just brought the curtain down.
But my father also took me a little bit further. He took me into the orchestral writing of Duke Ellington, which was very, very avant-garde in its time. He took me to see the Basie Band. You know, I did my chops there, really. And he also took me to my first rock and roll concert, which was kind of rock and roll in name alone, probably. It was more like kind of a rockabilly because it was Bill Haley, when I was 11 and a half years old. And prior to that, had taken time out to take me to a movie, several movies. He took me to A Girl Can't Help It, and he took me to Rock Around the Clock. Because he knew that I'd like it. And I remember once my friend Graham, who came with me, saying to him, "Do you like this music, Cliff?" You know, and my dad saying, he said, "Graham, I like anything that swings."
Come back. Pete talks about the function of music for his generation, teenage loneliness, and the women in his life. All this and more when we return with Pete Townsend one-on-one.
What was the function of music then in the 50s?
I think the function started to be about the fact that we needed music which was about escape, that we weren't really sure of our function, I don't think. We had, my generation, I was 2 years away from conscription, you know. I didn't have to go into the army. We didn't know what we were supposed to do. You know, we really didn't know what our function was going to be. And when it actually came to the moment that we brought that confrontation to our families, what it turned into was the fact that we were alone from that moment onward. I think that's what rock and roll is about. This is a kind of a fancy way of putting it, but I think rock and roll can be defined now like this. It's the dynamic between confrontation and escape. I mean that domestically. The moment when you confront your family or whoever's brought you up, you might be in an orphanage or an institution. I know not everybody has families, but you know, you confront those people and you release yourself, you become free, and there's a moment of freedom which then turns into acute loneliness because you are alone. And we had no culture of our own. We had no music, no style, no fashion, so we had to concoct it all. And I think that's what rock and roll did, is it just said, listen, we're alone, there's no system here, there's no process here for us, we understand now. And I think in England, what we did in the early 60s was appropriated R&B, because it was so plaintive, in a sense. It spoke so eloquently about the loneliness that we felt, you know.
And was
this... As individuals, I mean. Yeah, I don't mean as a group of people. I mean, you know, we were in crowds of people having fun, but, you know, each one of us was kind of hey, you know, what's weird about being a teenager is that, you know, if you leave home, you have to do your own laundry, you know. In a way, it's evidently central to all my work. It's very central in Tommy too. In fact, Tommy is about, it's a kind of, in a sense, it's kind of a lecture about what I've just said, a kind of a musical thing about, you know, the post-war years. But since I've been working on Tommy, I've made the link between Tommy and Quadrophenia and early work, and I've realised that this is all I ever write about, is this moment.
Well, was there a time where Tommy was more of a fictional character for you? And are you saying now that Tommy's much more of a personal character?
You know, I think if I average out throughout the stuff that I do, I think it's about 20% me and about 80% people like me. That's what I'd like to think. Mm. I mean, I think there have been moments when that ratio has been a bit swung backwards and forwards. I always thought Tommy was probably maybe 5% me and, you know, much more a kind of a Siddhartha story about a spiritual journey with a newly invented character. But in fact, it's not. It's actually the same ratio. There's a lot of me in Tommy, but there's also a lot of the kids that I grew up with and a lot of Roger and Keith and John and pals of mine and Kit Lambert and Ray Tolliday that I mentioned, people that I grew up with. And also the other thing is, you know, and I don't talk very much about the women in my life. You know, this is a thing that I don't do and I don't like to do it. But the women that are in there too, the girls that, you know, the interesting thing about the mod times, which began when The Who began, they weren't, you know, you have to, Quadrophenia was an acknowledgement of what had gone before. It was happening in the early 60s. The mod movement was very much a time when women changed, girls changed. They dressed like boys and they looked like boys. They appropriated boys' fashion. They cut their hair. They wore their hair very short. They defeminized themselves. But at the same time, they also got very, very pushy. It was a great time to be male in London. Mm. You know, you got propositioned. And it was slightly different to the life that I led at art school, where what I came across was open-minded, smart women for the first time. But in the dance halls, you know, there was something which... And I think I've actually failed as an artist to attend to that. I don't write about, you know, feminine values. And you know, I've always felt... I think this is why recently I was trying to actually project into my writing the idea that I've always carried those girls along with me. But I don't think I have, really.
When we return, Pete Townsend on writing songs about love, power, and perversion. Plus, the line that will haunt him until he really does die. Rolling Stone One-on-One with Pete Townsend returns on the Global Satellite Network.
When you write for the male voice, when you write for you and the other guys, there's always that element. That female element that filters into the songs. So many of the songs are about relationships with women, even if the women are not the narrators or the main characters in the songs.
Yeah, but don't you? I've always felt that one thing that The Who never did was write love songs. I remember barking at a friend of mine, Billy Nichols, recently, who does write love songs. I just said to him, you know, I don't write love songs. You know, and I thought, God, that sounded so angry, you know.
And I think, but you write love songs.
Well, you know, I don't know that I do. It's very difficult. You know, I think I'm not sure that I can tell anyway. Yeah. But do you know what I mean? It's something that I said it. I don't know whether I mean it.
Isn't Let My Love Open the Door a love song?
Well, it's about, isn't it about power? It's about power. It's about, and seduction.
Yeah. Love Reign Over Me.
That's about perversion, isn't it?
How about it? The Sea Refuses No River?
That's about destitution.
Or Stop Hurting. Love conquers poses, love smashes stances.
Oh, no, that's right. That is a love song.
Yeah,
that,
love crushes that, angels into black.
Oh, well, I actually wrote that for Karen, my wife, when we were separated briefly. Yeah. So, well, it wasn't that brief, but, I mean, we were separated. We're back together again now, and we have a new child. But that was a time, long time ago, about 10 years ago, that we were... I was really screwed up by breaking the band up, by Keith's death, by Kit Lambert's death, and by the fact that I had so much work to do, and I was drinking too much, and we were split up for a while, and I wrote that for her.
A love born once must soon be born again. A spark that burned then died, leaving cinders to be fanned by the wind. Thrown to flame. Flames like tongues impassioned in a moment's burst. Tell me, friend, why do you stand aloof from your own heart?
I guess it's inevitable that phrases are going to come out of you, like describing Roger as him becoming softer and more caring as he gets older. It's inevitable for people to go, oh, aren't these the guys that sang Hope I Die Before I Get Old? You know, that line is always going to come back to haunt you. How do you feel about that, about having been the epitome of that teen fist-clenched rebellion and now entering middle age and dealing with that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've given a number of smart answers to that question over the years. I think that the and some flippant ones as well, and sometimes I've just refused to answer it. I think that the thing I feel now is that, you know, I still carry the kid who wrote that. You know, I still carry the anger of it and the threat of it, and I still feel, and I think that that kid is pissed off that he didn't. Turn into James Dean, you know.
That he didn't die.
Yeah. But, you know, I think I'm afraid of it now. I'm not afraid of death. I'm not afraid of not being here. But I think I'm afraid of the idea that I might die and not be remembered. You know, I think that's the thing that... When I sang I Hope I Die Before I Get Old, I was already a star in a small firmament, but I was a star in England, you know. Can't explain had been a hit anyway had been a hit, and I'd written an album full of songs, some of which were standout material and a lot of which, you know, I wrote around the time of my generation were lasting songs. I was prolific and I was clever, and I knew that I wanted to be kind of more glamorous. I wanted to be more tragic. I wanted to be, you know, I think I understood celebrity, and I knew that I wasn't really, I was never going to be one of those kind of Jim Morrison kind of guys, you know. Didn't have the looks, didn't have... I suppose it was about not having the courage. And that statement was... I hope it wasn't hypocritical in a sense. I'm not saying that I didn't mean it, but it was an angry statement. I was living, you know, a good life at the time, but I wasn't accepted by the establishment in which I lived. You know, I wasn't rock and roll, and people like me were not considered to be worthy of living, really. You know, and I mean, we were, you know, I used to live in Belgravia at the time because it's where Kit used to live, and with the aristocracy of England's establishment, and I'd go to Harrods to do my shopping, and women in fur coats would literally just shove me out of the way. When I bought my first good car, I remember driving down Beecham Place, which is a famous shopping street in London, and another woman coming past me in another convertible, and we got stopped in a traffic jam, and she looked over at me and she said, "Driving Mummy's car, are we, darling?" And I thought, why is she saying that? You know, why is she saying that? You know, why does she even think that? Why doesn't she believe that somebody that's 24 years old can actually buy a convertible Mercedes or whatever it was I was in? And without robbing a bank. And when are they going to accept that what I'm doing is art? So a lot of that anger was directed at them, you know, that, you know, I don't want to be old like you're old. I don't want to ever become like you.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
My generation. My generation, baby.
Around the corner, Why Tommy hits the stage in the 90s. And would Tommy's audience be considered psychedelics? More with Pete Townsend one-on-one on the Global Satellite Network.
What made you decide to finally go with Tommy as a theatrical production? I know people have been after you for years to try and mount a full-scale stage production. Why did you finally decide now in the 90s to do it?
I think because the audience seems to be about ready for it, you know. But also I think because now the story can be told using technology, and you know, the technology has arrived. I'm paraphrasing Des McAnuff here, who actually said this in an interview recently, that he feels that you know, the elegance of the computer systems that now are available in the theatre are very necessary for the way that he has decided to tell the story, with slides and changing backgrounds and moving scenery.
So it's necessary to do Tommy in a theatre as a theatrical production to bring these other elements to it. You just couldn't simply mount a kind of a concert, which you've done in the past. That's not what you were looking to do now.
No, I think... you know, there's something very interesting about the rock song, which is that, and Tommy was very much a rock project in that it didn't have an ending, really. You know, it didn't, and I don't think you draw conclusions in rock and roll. What you actually do is you share ideas and you share feelings and you talk about transitory emotions, and you know, and one of the, you know, the smart things to do in rock and roll is to play dumb. You know, you don't tell people what to think, ever.
We'll be fighting in the streets with our children at our feet, and the morals that they worship will be gone, and the men who spurred us on, sitting judgment of all wrong. If your child ain't all he should be now, this girl will put him right. I'll show him what he could be now, just give me one night. I'm the gypsy, the acid queen, pay me before I start. I'm the gypsy, I'm guaranteed to tear you so. Ever since I was a young boy, from Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all, but I've never seen anything like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb and blind kid sure plays mean pinball. He stands like a statue, becomes part of the machine, leaning on the bumpers but always playing clean. He plays by intuition, the duty count as ball. That deaf, dumb and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
How important was your decision to cast unknowns in the play, especially the part of Tommy?
You know, I don't think it was that important. It's starting to take on a kind of significance now, because you start to think, well, if there had been a well-known artist up there, let's use a girl, because then we can actually and obviously it wouldn't be the person that we cast. Let's say Bernadette Peters, you know, if Tommy was, you know, Tomita or whatever. I think it would be a different kind of show. It would be a different kind of show. Yeah. I mean, I know she's a musical comedy artist, but it would feel different. I don't want to name any male names, because I just think it would, in a sense, be a reduction of present the idea that they wouldn't be able to do it as well as Michael Cerveris can do it. I think that he's growing constantly, Michael. That's what really excites me about him, that he's changed so much in the time that I've known him and grown so much that I think that, he's going to grow with the role and he's going to help to define the role in its new form. I think the main thing is that anybody, you know, if Bernadette Peters did it, one thing that they wouldn't do is compare her to Roger Daltrey, apart from the curly hair, maybe. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It would be like whoever did it would be compared to... Well, let's pick some names of people who could take it. Let's say Mick Jagger could do it. I mean, he's the same age as Roger. One of the reasons neither that could do them is that they're both too
they're
old.
Too old, yeah.
But, you know, supposing Roger had done it. I mean, when Rod Stewart did the role of Pinball Wizard, when Elton John did the role of Pinball Wizard, I don't think that they were compared to Roger directly. But if you actually play the role of Tommy in anything, you're going to be compared to Roger, and Roger helped define the role. So it's very important that you've got a courageous, strong, and individual newcomer to do the role.
Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh.
How will children react to Tommy? How have they at this up until now?
Well, the only child that I've seen at a preview was a couple of yards in front of me and seemed to be having fun. I don't know.
I mean, who is the audience for Tommy now? Is it an audience of middle-aged, former 60s hippie types looking for some sort of nostalgic link to their past, or is the audience much more vital and alive?
You know, that audience that you've just described should go out and buy my solo album. You know, I've just done an album for those guys.
Have you?
Yeah.
Now, what's the name of this album?
Psycho Derelict. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
That's about Pete? The dream, you know, the lost dream of the hippie years, about how it's all got kind of chewed up by the mechanism of information technology and the exactness of the press, that in our effort to define everything that we dreamed of, we reduced it to nothing.
The conclusion of our conversation with Pete Townsend when we return with more of Rolling Stone One-on-One.
The Who are celebrating their 30th anniversary this year. 1963 marked the beginning of The Who. Here it is now, 1993. And I alluded to the fact that you've alluded to the fact that there may be some idea of some sort of celebration. Is there anything you can tell us
about
that?
You know, I don't know when that was. I think Roger's alluded a couple of times to the fact that... I think last year I was thinking that we might do a new recording. Or maybe the year before. And then I had a cycling accident, which we talked about earlier, did we?
No, we haven't talked about
that. Yeah, I had a cycling accident.
You fell off your motorcycle?
I fell off a push bike. Sailing and I arrived at an island about 60 miles off England and exhilarated and went down, pedalled up a hill on a rented bike, went down the other side and fell off and really smashed my wrist up. And that kind of put paid to any new recording, really.
You can't play.
I can play now, but this is, you know, you know, when you smash your wrist up, it's a kind of very complicated joint, and they should make, you know, somebody should make some kind of nylon or, you know, titanium replacement, because I need a new wrist, really. It's a mess in there.
So it's painful for you to play now, but
it hurts a bit while I'm playing, but, you know, we have things called drugs to deal with that, thank heavens, in the modern world. And I can't damage it any more than it's been damaged. But it feels very different. I can't do a lot of the things I'm famous for.
We talked earlier about you not wanting to die without being remembered for something. What do you think 100 years from now people will remember Pete Townsend for? Not what you want them to remember you for, but what do you think they'll remember
you for? I
think
I'll be remembered for Tommy, principally. Because it's actually... I've had a chance to close the loop. You know, I've had several attempts at putting it right, and I think I finally got it right. And there's a book. There's the music, the book, the orchestration. It can now be played by whole groups of people. It can be used by schools and by academies and be translated. I think if I do anything as wonderful, again, I'll be delighted. But, you know, I was 24 years old when I wrote it, full of ideas, full of energy. You know, I lived in a recording studio day and night. You know, I don't do that stuff anymore.
Pete Townsend, thank you so much for being the first guest on Rolling Stones.
Oh, it's been great. And I'll listen out for your later guests. And good luck with the idea. It's a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Been listening to Rolling Stone Magazine's One-on-One with Pete Townsend, brought to you by AT&T and by Dentene. We'll take care of your breath. The rest is up to you. One-on-One with Pete Townsend was hosted by Ben Scalsa. Creative production and engineering by Chris Lindsley. Special thanks to Kara Manning and Rolling Stone Magazine and to John Valenzuela and George Taylor Morris. Rolling Stone One-on-One was produced by Jim Villanueva. Executive producer Howard Gilman. Rolling Stone One-on-One is a presentation of the Global Satellite Network.
Listening to you, I get the music, gazing at you.